Welcome everybody to the session General Insurance Reserving Robust Statistical Process or Artisanal Cottage Industry. So after the talk you can make the call. Okay, we have two presenters today for this session, Trevor Jack. Trevor is a part-time self-employed actuary who spends more time sailing and developing sailing technology than being an actuary. He retains an interest in technical actuarial work, and much of his work for some decades has involved long-tail reserving. Matthew is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and an associate director with Dynamo Analytics. Matthew has a broad actuarial consulting experience across the Australian, UK and Nordic markets, advising insurers and government clients on reserving and capital with a focus on leveraging technology to improve actuarial processes. I will now hand over to Matthew and Trevor.
Perfect. Thanks, Susan. Okay. So just as I start off, a little bit more context on what we're speaking about today. I've got a strong interest in reserving from designing, implementing and operating processes in particularly in Australia and the UK and a little bit in other regions. This session we're primarily talking about the techniques for setting outstanding claims reserves, but we will kind of touch on some of the upstream and downstream elements of the overall process, so things like data prep, triangulation, diagnostics, allocations, management reporting, statutory reporting and so on. Views are very much our own, or those of the group of experienced reserving actuaries that we spoke to as part of this, and it should be clear where that distinction is. And focusing in on Australia, I think worth keeping in mind that our local approach to reserving has been historically in some ways more rigorous or sophisticated than other markets. That could be owing to factors like our injury schemes, the sorts of regulatory requirements that we've had for a while, and the research produced by Australian actuaries. Some examples of that are the kind of payment per claim approaches and modelling splits by payment type. That said, there's probably not a lot about reserving in Australia that looks substantially different to 20 or perhaps 30 years ago, which is in stark contrast to other areas such as pricing. And Trevor's going to take that idea a little further. So Trevor and I both have our impressions of the current state in Australia from our respective roles. But we've sought to validate and challenge these by speaking to a number of actuaries through structured conversations and a survey, as well as some ad hoc discussions with a range of people involved with the education program. So these views include experienced actuaries from corporates and consulting firms. The members of the Institute's recently formed GI Reserving Working Group, members of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries Machine Learning and in Reserving Working Party, academics and contributors to the education program. Most of the views I'm going to share here are from those of large corporates and consultants about the work that they do at their organisations. And I'd note that sample size is fairly small, but we do think it's broadly representative of the industry at this point. In terms of methodologies, there is really a huge prevalence of what I'd term traditional techniques for setting central estimates. What I mean by that is that the heuristic approaches such as chain ladder, BF payment per claims and so on, either in spreadsheets, proprietary software or open source scripting languages. Many are using stochastic approaches, but typically just for estimating reserve risk and doing things like risk margin and risk adjustment. In terms of parameterisation, there are some examples of more automation or sophistication here. So claims level analysis or ML techniques, which can take things beyond, I guess, the classic average last four type approach. A little bit more on the current state. There are some good examples of more automated processes, either using specialised software or open source tools. And the primary benefit that's been spoken about is around control and governance, from reducing points of manual intervention. And in some cases, it's also enabled more regular reserving, so, for instance, monthly reserving. There are some examples of granular modelling, so for instance, claim level modelling. It's usually restricted to simple deterministic or hybrid approaches. There are some instances of full reliance on granular methods for certain classes, but these are usually for specific classes, perhaps latent claims or very small portfolios. Other approaches, so beyond traditional methods, there's some examples of broader use of stochastic models, but there's also a perception that these are fairly impractical to implement. That said, the advantages that are spoken of is both the ability to estimate the central estimate as well as the broader distribution. For better or worse, I don't think there were many surprises that came out of these conversations. Later on, I'll talk about some of the barriers to change through the eyes of the participants, as they're quite helpful in understanding this current state. For now, I'm going to hand over to Trevor to talk through reserving as statistical forecasting.
Morning, everyone. Matt just showed me the picture that came through for me on the bio, which I was very pleased to see was me kiting down at Wellington Point nearby rather than a corporate shot, and that is an indicator of where I spend more of my time. Having said that, I started using spreadsheet triangle models 30 years ago in the UK where I did my training, so I've done quite a few over the years. But it seems to be I'm a little bit like a late religious convert to stochastic models, because having learned how to use them, I look back and think to myself, goodness me, why did I do all those spreadsheets? But anyway, now, down button, is it? There we go. One of our correspondents, our survey correspondents, asked this question. Is there any reason that loss reserving should not be viewed as an exercise in statistical forecasting? I could do a survey here and say who they say yes to that, but let's not do that. My view is that the answer is no. It should be viewed as that. Leave aside for now the question of machine learning, which is that stochastic or not. We'll come back to that. And just consider the difference between heuristic and stochastic models. The heuristic ones have statistical elements, of course, but I'm using that term to distinguish between the conventional approaches and a more formal statistical model. I thought to myself, what is this discipline of statistics? What's its purpose? It's the science that formally assesses patterns in data and draws inferences from those data. And then if you think, well, what are we doing if we look at data in order to estimate a reserve? That's pretty much what we're trying to do. So it seems self-evident to me that a formal statistical approach is more likely to be suitable than ad hoc ones. As I say, I'm a bit of a late convert to this and maybe have some religious zeal to it that I shouldn't have. But if we achieve anything through this process, both through my contributions to the GIPC working group and this talk, if it's to get younger people to start on this journey earlier than I did, I'll be quite pleased. There's a list of a few documents there. I'm not going to go through them, just a few points. McCulloch and Nelder, I think, is the seminal textbook in the field for GLMs. That's certainly what I read way back when I was a pricing actuary and did use it. And there are no doubt others. I see Greg's here. He can probably quote 15. But that's a good starting point. There's a 1976 paper that Greg referred me to for GLMs in pricing, and I highlight that primarily as an indicator that it was used in pricing way back then. Having said that, there's a note of, I think it's 1990, is it, GLMs in reserving, so it was known for reserving back then. But there's a 1995 paper by Dave Finnis and others, which was a survey of reserving methods. I read that and there was no mention of GLMs at all. And that's not a criticism. It wasn't intended to be a technical paper. But I think that's an indicator that GLMs just weren't in use even a decade or two after they were used for pricing. Now, maybe there's a good reason for that, and people who've done assessments of them and said, oh, they don't work, we don't want them. That's not my view, and I'll be trying to express that here. Our target audience here is practitioners, and I would recommend, and there may be others, but the McCulloch and Nelder and the Taylor and Maguire, the most helpful. I don't really think it's possible, I'll come back to this, to do this sort of work without an adequate statistical foundation. It is quite possible to get application-specific software or get code that runs in Python or R that will do all this work, but I question whether it's possible to do that properly without the adequate statistical understanding. Hence my reference to McCulloch and Nelder as a necessary starting point, and the Taylor and Maguire is an excellent short monograph which gives implementation, code, everything. You could do that without understanding the basis, but I will leave that for further discussion. Nothing happened. Did anything happen?
Yep.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yep. The first series of arrow points there is what I'm characterising as a statistical approach. If you read through them, you'll think to yourself, I think I did something called control cycle once, and that's pretty much it. And whether that's a control cycle that happens through the course of a single valuation or every time you turn the handle each year or 6 months, whatever it is, it's essentially the control cycle. And most of it is entirely applicable to a conventional approach as it is to a GLM approach. I'm just going to highlight two differences. The diagnostics that come out of a GLM approach, and I'll use GLM interchangeably with stochastic. It's not quite accurate, but most stochastic implementations will be GLMs. the suite of diagnostics that comes out of a GLM approach is just so much more powerful than is easily available from conventional and spreadsheet approaches. I don't mean it's not possible with spreadsheets, but the difference is substantial in terms of cost of implementation. The other point I want to highlight, says redefine and respecify the model. How many times have I spent some time setting up a beautiful spreadsheet, which is accident half period by development half period perhaps, then looked at some trends and think, oh, geez, it would have been handy if I had a different dimension in there. And then it takes me a while to go back and do that. Maybe I pull it out of a normalised data set into a pivot table and it doesn't take too long. But using a scripting language, and in particular going from there into a GLM, it's so much easier and more quick to do that and further to segment further. I've got a few dot points there about chain ladders. I don't want to dwell on those. We're all familiar with them. We've probably all read the relevant documentation about in what circumstances and in what ways they are statistically robust. But my experience, and I'll put my hand up here, mostly from my use of them, is that they're not implemented in a robust manner, and their testing is very different from what's possible, and even, I won't say necessary, but it flows logically from using a GLM software package. The last point there, how does actuarial judgment differ from data science? I'm not a great fan of the term actuarial judgment. It seems to me to be used to mean, I don't quite understand the statistics, but I'm an actuary, so I'll wave my hands and now there's a number called the actuarial judgment OCL. If I'm correct in what data scientists do, and I don't claim to be a data scientist or be involved in that field, a good statistician is making judgments all the time. So one of the criticisms we've had, or objections perhaps the term is, in discussing these matters with our survey respondents, has been along the lines of, you don't have room for judgment and, you know, there may be something that's not in the data. Our contention would be, that's all entirely possible within a GLM structure and even easier than that. I'm going to go on to something about machine learning. Again, hands up. I'm a late convert to GLMs and not even a convert to machine learning yet. Matt knows more about them. We're not going to cover them here. The only point is to say maybe they're a statistical form, not really, probably. But they have some similarities structurally with what we advocate for the purposes of GLMs, and that is essentially they're code and script based, so that and the that gives the opportunity for version control. You're running it through Git or whatever version control software you use. And the data, this, I think this is probably the most important point, that the data is not entangled with the model. If you structure a aggregate triangle, accident, quarter by development, quarter, whatever it is, once you've done that and you've got your formulas which say go up 3, go across 4, check your grandmother's age, all that stuff, it's all entangled. Whereas with machine learning, let's say a scripting-based approach, whether that be machine learning or GLIM or other, you've got normalised data and you've got a model and you run the model against that, and they're not like that. Let's see. Now, I think I've got a couple more. Yeah. So benefits and barriers. Matt's going to talk more about general matters. I thought it was worthwhile just raising a couple of examples for those not familiar. A fair bit of that first bit I've spoken about already, so the scripting language, and I think most, I hope all implementations of this sort of thing would write to a log file as it's done. So every time you run a model, all the results go to a log file, it's timestamped, the user's there. Because of the timestamp, you can go back to Git and check what version was used. It's so much more robust than a spreadsheet. And, of course, there's no reason. It's just a text file. You just go and add some commentary at the time. If that's it's invariably valuable for me. I've got notes there. I said, gee, the guy who did this was an idiot because da-da-da-da. So that gets ignored. What do I said about model diagnostics? Yeah, there's a much wider suite. We'll just cover one example of the wide suite of diagnostics now. In fact, we'll cover two examples, both of which just use heat maps. So you see here, I don't want to try pointing with another device. The vertical side is accident period grouping, and then the horizontal is development period grouping. So it's a standard triangle in some sense. The groupings are not homogenous. I wanted big cells so that we could see something. And who can tell the difference between those two heat maps? Any hands up? Because if you can, you're lying. No, okay, they're very similar. But they're different models. I know they're different because the scale at the top's slightly different. That's the only thing I can see that's different. But the models that are run, you can see the model statements below. One has a payment per claim settled, with the predictors being just operational time and experience period. And let's forget about collinearities and everything for now. The second one has the same, but with operational time crossed with a segmentation variable. I think in this case that segmentation variable only had two levels. And at the end of that statement, you can see there's some more red, and that's a name that flows through into all the output files, so they're distinguished. My point is that there are two quite different models which take, four keystrokes in order to run differently. They're quite different. They give similar results, and we've got a whole pile of other diagnostics which confirm what one would view simply confirm from these heat maps, that segmentation variable provides no extra information. It should be cut out. Another example, same dimensions. Notice that the accident period, the later accident periods and the earlier development periods are smaller groupings. Those cells are much smaller. They've got one unit instead of 10 at the end. And in this case, the heat maps are very different. On the left is the result of running a GLM. The model specification is down the bottom, and in this one there is a segmentation variable. On the right is a spreadsheet model, with the results of which were back projected into the same structure so that we can get the same results out. You'll notice that the relevant, the most important diagonal, the last three cells or so in the diagonal, are quite similar. So one might conclude that the spreadsheet model does fine, and it may well be fine. I'm not going to opine on whether which of these two is a better model. The one with the GLM has more predictors, so the information criteria may be poorer, and the one on the right clearly doesn't back project to the early periods at all well. Maybe we don't want it to. Maybe it doesn't matter, and there's a good reason that it should be like that. The point is, with this approach, you have statistically significant levels on all those predictors which have been used to get rid of all the red stuff in the top left of the right one, and can more easily assess whether that's a more suitable model or not. I've gone off script here. You might have gathered that. I think that you're next, Matt.
Yeah, I'll pick it up from there. Great, thanks. Thanks, Trevor. I just wanted to, I guess, broaden this concept of better reserving. GLM's certainly a useful tool in that. But there are other things that you can do. And I just wanted to kind of play this out before I get back to some of the comments that we got from our participants. I should say that this is one idea. This is not one size fits all. It's going to depend a lot on things like class of business, volume and quality of data, materiality of the business, and just the ability for your teams to kind of implement different things. With that in mind, at the bottom we've kind of got our traditional spreadsheet approach. The first step away from this is implementing a level of automation and governance around those traditional methods. So Trevor's spoken about one approach with open source and proper version tracking and so on. The next is building on this with further automation, particularly kind of to the left and the right of your core reserving process. So automating that data side and the reporting side. Next is evolving that into more of a top-down diagnostic-led approach. So this can have further benefits to insights, responsiveness, and the ability to just perform the process more quickly. Some options from there could be to introduce better segmentation. So that can bring better alignment with the assumptions underlying your projection methodology, as well as techniques to get a better first cut of model parameters. And then we've got that step change, I guess, to a stochastic approach, which perhaps a GLM or an extension into machine learning algorithms. And then finally, you might consider the use of granular modelling, so at the policy or claims level, and that's where you can really draw on the information that gets lost when you aggregate up to triangles. Okay, so with those potential strategies in mind, I wanted to speak briefly about the benefits that you could realise through that process. So speed and efficiency, spending less time on setting up spreadsheets, picking loads of assumptions by eye, manually preparing volumes of reporting. It does free up the time for actuarial skills to be applied to other things than perhaps repetitive tasks. On the risk side, reducing the cost of operational risk incidents and meeting the evolving expectations of auditors, regulators, and management. Team engagement, looking after your teams, less time pressure, better spread of effort across the calendar, and opportunities for analysts and actuaries to develop their skills in more modern and sophisticated techniques. Hopefully better engagement and retention as well. There's potential wider business benefits, so more time for investigating the trends inside and outside of the data, deep dives into particular segments or other contributions, better monitoring, less surprises, and perhaps more frequent reserving. Compliance and profession. Trevor will pick this up in a little bit more detail later, but consider how well we're currently meeting the regulatory requirements, as well as how we're contributing to the credibility of the profession, so it's one with rigorous mathematical and statistical underpinnings. Also one that's not standing still, but is evolving to use the tools that are at our disposal. Finally, appropriateness. So the ability of models to emulate the underlying processes, for example, to pick up on things like calendar period effects, and to achieve better performance in terms of bias variance trade-offs, and avoid kind of statistically dubious parameters. Now, we sought to understand the barriers to change. So what follows here is a summary and some anecdotes from the people we spoke to, and I'm going to add some comments in response to these as well. On upskilling and teams, there's concerns around skills to implement and operate more sophisticated approaches, particularly at corporates. There's a comment that the ability to interrogate and understand data is universal and will remain regardless of process improvements. We've seen the emerging role of the dedicated modelling team at some organisations, so those who develop and manage models as distinct from the actuarial teams operating the models themselves. And this does have some great advantages in terms of tailoring skills to tasks and the differing skill sets. You do need to structure it in a way that's appropriate, and the governance side also becomes much more important. There's also a challenge in just upskilling analysts and actuaries within a more automated process, perhaps where they can't just click on cells in a spreadsheet and trace through links as easily. Communication's seen as a barrier as well, so it could be harder for reserving committees and boards who are familiar with current approaches and exhibits. Users of reports and outputs would need education. Getting buy-in from other stakeholders, such as auditors, EPR, can be tricky, kind of reinforcing this reluctance for change. Conversely, there was a recognition that targeting improvements can bring positives, identifying trends which would otherwise be overlooked, for instance, or more easily investigating and breaking down drivers, supporting assumption setting, providing more narrative, which is a growing expectation of consulting clients. Budget and capacity is a perennial concern. Time for actuaries to invest in the process itself can be limited, particularly at some corporates. Benefits can be difficult to quantify, and also acknowledging that changes in sophistication of the process can have impacts on audit budgets. For example, the level of documentation required may increase with non-standard methods.
Sorry, can I say non-conventional methods?
By all means, yeah. some brief notes in response to those. So on the upskilling and teams, there's a wealth of free and accessible information out there. Trevor's mentioned a few resources. The IFOA's Machine Learning and Reserving Working Party has published a lot of freely accessible information that's valuable even if you're not looking at ML. And also consider whether there's skills in other teams to draw on or perhaps externally. I think anyone that's been involved in grad recruitment recently would have seen the strongly growing interest in data science. And so think about how we leverage that interest and the related training that universities now provide. That can really help progress initiatives. I'd also contend that there's kind of a dwindling number of younger actuaries that will be content operating the sorts of algorithms that have been in place for decades when they can see how modelling has progressed in some other areas. So keeping that younger generation interested in reserving has been quietly acknowledged as a motivator by some of the insurers that we've worked with. Regarding communication, I would say that exhibits used in slide decks or dashboards are likely to offer more rather than less, and they don't necessarily need to change a great deal. There's also likely to be more time for actuaries to perform deep dives on topical issues and classes, and that can help with the communication side. On budgets, there are ways of quantifying things. It's not necessarily easy, but looking at process efficiency, so hours spent, reserve volatility, so measuring reduction in internal systemic risk, scenario testing, so looking at the impact of operational risk events on the team's time, as well as potential engagement costs with auditors and regulators. Benefits to insights, monitoring and responsiveness can all lead to kind of a competitive advantage. And in terms of securing a dedicated budget for making change, I'd note that current priorities of the organisation can align. So whether that's digitalisation, finance transformation, or AI, which is quite topical, you may get some benefit from aligning with that. Auditors, we expect, are also likely to be supportive of a change which brings better governance and perhaps an automated, standardised set of audit outputs. Okay, I'll move on to the next set of barriers. Most of the actuaries we spoke to did cite data as being at least somewhat of a concern for making their reserving processes more sophisticated, particularly where absent or sparse data precludes traditional methods, and there's more reliance on things like benchmarks or pricing basis or more art than science approaches. There's also a lament about the general quality of data received from consulting clients, which can make it harder to automate the ETL and get the benefit on that side, and perhaps even to apply traditional methods in a sensible way. There's a comment that pricing has more flexibility than reserving when it comes to the data that's used for modelling. So, for instance, the ability to just focus on more recent, higher quality data sets rather than the entirety of the data available. There was also some further comments around over-reliance on data-driven reserving in general. So in the sense that it's a lagging measure, that a more sophisticated modelling approach may shift the focus too far away from forward-looking considerations, such as trends in claims behaviour and the overall economic environment. Several respondents also noted that data can just be an easy excuse. On the judgment side, the ease of overlaying expert judgment was seen as a strength of traditional methods. It was noted that aggregate deterministic methods can be adjusted fairly easily to respond to known environment changes, such as legislation change. And overall, the need for intervening and applying judgment was seen as undermining some of the value of a more automated approach. In terms of risk, the risk profile of reserving was seen as a challenge when considering change. So there's a lot of conservatism there, the potential financial statement impact of process change, and all the attention that can generate. In terms of granular modelling specifically, there's a concern that important systemic effects could be dismissed as noise, whereas they would be detected and allowed for at an aggregate level. Finally, there was a comment that there doesn't appear to be industry consensus on what model types are the next step, which can make it harder when broaching the idea of change with senior stakeholders and with auditors. I'll breeze through these responses, but I'd point out on the data side that quantity and quality affects traditional methods. They don't uniquely preclude the use of a triangle GLM formulation. So it's not always an excuse that holds water. In terms of concern about reliance on data and kind of traditional approaches in general, this may actually, in a more automated approach, it may allow you to spend more time talking to underwriters or to claims teams or to make judgments more explicit and better supported. And on the judgment side, there's still mechanisms where judgment can be applied. That said, there is an argument for less intervention, perhaps to reduce bias, and that's made possible by the advances in modelling approach. On the risk side, finally, some comments around kind of the perceived and actual risks. It's possible to move conservatively here. So running alternatives in parallel for several reserving exercises, fully evaluating appropriateness, and then transitioning over at an appropriate time. For instance, if you did claims level modelling, you can retain aggregate triangle approaches in parallel in a more automated way and then use them as a diagnostic or a cross-check. Okay, I'll throw it over to Trevor now to talk a little bit about changes for individuals and teams. Am I? Let's see. Yeah, I'll do this one. All right. So bringing challenge to the status quo. This is building the business case, probably the number one step here. This is about measuring current process. So I mentioned before, quantifying the time on each aspect, categorising that, analysing it to see where time is spent, whether that's high-value activities or something that could be done in an automated way. Identifying and articulating the risks inherent but that might be hidden in the current process. So potential or realised operational risk incidents, things like hard-coded overrides, old links, formula errors that can be quite prevalent. Delayed identification of trends as well in the data and whether the process is defensible to auditors and the regulator. And then identifying and articulating the strategic value, which I've mentioned some of these ideas, as well as considering team engagement. With that business case in hand, planning a pathway, so mapping out that kind of end state where you want to get to, and then prioritising really ruthlessly about the ordering and how ambitious you want to move towards that target state. Thinking about things like the platform or the tools you're going to use, the data that's available, whether there's work to do on the data side first, methodologies, and of course the reporting that you need out of the back of it. And then focusing on the change that's needed to achieve appropriate rigour and governance. So given the available data, the nature of the business, what's appropriate for the classes that you're reserving. Finally, getting your team involved. So harnessing that enthusiasm that you might have within the team for change or for doing something different. Start designing little bits and pieces, little proof of concepts, prototyping. There's lots of resources out there. I've highlighted the Taylor and Maguire monogram as being a really good resource if you're looking down that GLM path. Okay, now I think I can throw it over to Trevor. Yeah.
I think the bloke who spoke before, Matt, might have waffled on a little too long, so we're a little short of time, so I'm going to try and redress that here by being quite quick. So I'm looking at what the profession may need to do to make this happen. And I've got to emphasise that this is the views of Matt and I, that the profession should do something because we think this should happen. It's not the view of GIPC, it's not the view of GI Reserving Working Group. If we have some sway, it may become that, but this is very clearly our views. I'm going to cover the survey, various bits of training possibilities. I'm going to cover the survey actually very quickly, because some of it we've covered before, and it essentially is quite different to... I'm not sure whether the plural of first person, singular first person is appropriate. Certainly different to my views. So we've covered some of those. I'll leave you to read them. I'm going to now come onto my views. The university training, I think this is quite seminal. I think to do rigorous statistical work, you need a strong mathematical statistical training. That's not to say that every actuary needs that, and nor is it to say that such training is sufficient to be a good actuary. It's certainly not sufficient, but I would contend that it's necessary for some areas of reserving. And those sort of questions and statements come from that view. When I was employing Sean O'Mara, I was very pleased to find that he was mathematically trained, rather than actuarially trained. Now, I know that's a very personal view, and others may share it, but my observations recently are that the rigour in mathematics and statistics of the university actuarial courses is rather less than I think is desirable. I would go further and say that that sort of rigorous training in fundamentals of mathematics and statistics is the sort of thing that I think is better done at university than the practical implications of data science. If you have the foundational training, then the practical implementation is much easier learned on the job. Professional courses and CPD. What do my notes say? The Data Science Practice Committee are looking quite carefully at how to improve many of the profession's members in data science, and that translates to this area in particular. GI RWG, General Insurance Reserving Working Group, will work through that. CPD, interesting question. My notes here say this is a question as to whether or not formal CPD is helpful. So I don't. It's very clear that we, as a profession, if we wish to move this way to implement, need professional development. Whether that should be formal or not, I'm not so sure. I have not done any formal CPD in respect of stochastic modelling, but I've read some good papers, and now I consider myself quite proficient. So CPD, I'm not sure. The question about CPD for senior actuaries is sort of a different one. If I'm the senior reserving actuary and have 10 staff on a huge portfolio, and they all have time to learn how to do the coding and bring me all this GLM stuff, what do I do? Do I say, Barleys, I don't understand GLM, go back and do spreadsheets? Or do I learn enough in order to understand the GLMs? Or do I get them to make sure that I understand enough? I would lean towards the third of those, but it's an important question to consider. I'm just going to go to... Oh, that was too far. Professional standards. A list of several regulatory and professional requirements there. I'm not going to go through them in detail. But I don't think we need any more. I think some of those imply that we should be doing GLMs, at least to investigate them. Right? If you're complying with the professional guidance and have not the skill or the implementation of modern techniques, I think it's questionable whether you're complying. That's not to say that I think it's unprofessional. I think the professional standards probably say that if everyone else is doing it, you're probably doing the right thing. My view is that everyone else is using spreadsheets, and maybe in some circumstances that's not right. We don't contend that these sort of approaches should be used in every circumstance, I should emphasise. But there are many circumstances that I've required models for where it's very clearly a better approach. A practice note of some sort may be a better way to go. I'm going to finish there. Matt's got a few more things to say, but if I could just take this very brief opportunity to thank him for his help in this. I've had a few things going on recently that have made it quite difficult. He's been very, very...
Thanks, everyone. I'll hand it over for questions. I'll just make three quick points, I guess, to wrap up what you've said today. Traditional triangle reserving algorithms are dominant in the GI reserving market in 2024. Those who've taken steps, whether they're small or large, towards more automation or more advanced approaches do see genuine benefits. And we contend that the profession should be supporting and encouraging these sorts of steps through avenues such as university curricula, education program and CPD. Over to you, Susan.
Okay. Oh. Can you hear me? Yeah, perfect. Okay, we've got a couple of questions coming through on the app. If people have got a couple of minutes just to hang around so that we don't have to run out quickly. I'm going to use my privilege to ask a first question. You're sort of saying that the Australian profession is probably not where it would ideally be. Do you see around the world other countries where the profession is more advanced, and what can we learn from them about getting there?
I'll have a go at that. I won't speak to every country, but certainly some of the areas of reserving, some elements of reserving are more advanced in other markets, but it's kind of fairly hit and miss from what I've seen. So, for instance, in the UK, there's probably a bigger focus on the stochastic side, but they don't have quite the range of traditional deterministic techniques that we use in Australia. I think we can look to them in terms of understanding that stochastic modelling and how it's used in practice. The US, I've had some small exposure there as well. And they've, in a different regulatory environment where they're not necessarily booking the central estimate, they may do more analysis to understand like a 60th percentile, for instance. So again, a little bit more of a focus on that, that distributional approach. But overall, I think these same questions, I've seen them come up in the UK and elsewhere, and many of the same answers, GLMs being an example, would apply in those markets as the next step. One final thing I'll say on that, there's a lot of interest in auto-parameterisation of chain ladder and BF in the UK. So ways of picking your patterns in a more automated way using ML.
Thank you. The next one is a statement. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts. Arguably, the use of judgment is currently in assumption setting results in smoothing / staged assumption changes over time, reducing volatility in profit impacts. Would you agree? And any comments about if we move to different methods?
I may have said some controversial things already. This seems to be another opportunity. Back when I was a corporate actuary, we called that profit smoothing. I think that's enough said.
I don't think I'll try and add to that.
Okay, the last question on the app. The 2006 GI Reserving Survey, also the UK and CAS ones, predicted far more use of cohesive models by now. The questioner would welcome your further comment on that. Is it just that there's been limited claims inflation to create a burning platform for change, or some other reason why we're not seeing far more use?
I think the projection of the uptake of the stochastic models and such was done in a spreadsheet.
I think the barriers, I mean, my experience doesn't extend back to 2006, if I'm honest, but I suspect that the barriers that applied in 2006 weren't terribly different to today. In fact, we've got some better answers on the tools side now. So I suspect what I talked through would have been quite relevant back then as well. There was another survey I think Aston conducted a few years ago on reserving techniques worldwide, and it's painted a very similar picture to what we see today. So if you're thinking back maybe 6 or 7 years, that time frame, not much has changed, and that appears to extend back to 2006 as well.
I might just add a little bit. I think probably there's a limited perception of the value of moving. So I've done lots of reserves using both conventional and stochastic models, and the central estimate is often quite similar. And if that's the case, then why would you bother changing? Until you've done it and seen the insight you can get from the stochastic approach, even if you're getting a similar result, it's not entirely clear why it's beneficial. Once you have done it and have all the robustness that comes with that approach, it's a lay down the zero. But I don't think part of the reason we're doing this talk is in order to encourage people to look at those aspects and then make a consideration as to whether it's worthwhile.
And just a last question. You're talking here about moving away from being a cottage industry. To your mind, in 2 years' time, if we're successfully on that journey, what would we see?
2 years from now, I hope I'll be sailing up the Queensland coast and not thinking about reserving very much. It's not going to be a quick transition. So 2 years from now, I don't think we'll see anything much that's different in published results and reports to companies and whatever. I hope that 2 years from now, there will be the starting of a groundswell of probably mostly the younger members of the profession who have said, actually, I need to learn how to do this, and I'll just implement this in my own time, and then I'll go and see the boss and say, look, here's the spreadsheet, here's the GLM, looks pretty good. And I think it's going to, if 2 years is your time frame, that's about all I expect to see. But hopefully 6-8 years from now, those same 2 years from now, junior actuaries will be a little more senior and will become more widespread. I made that up on the spot.
I'd broadly agree with that. I think the two areas I'd love to see progress in the next few years would be consensus on those next steps, and probably a bit of evolution on the tools side. So whether that's the prepackaged software side or the packages in open source tools, making those more widely used, available, and just more off the shelf to give people a step up on that journey.
Please join me in thanking our presenters, Trevor and Matthew.